In this edition of Audio Berkman,
the idea of looking at software for bugs, for things that can be exploited for purposes other than those which the developers intended, is exciting, it's intellectually engaging, it's actually quite socially important, but it's also really legally risky.
Derek Bambauer talks about the impact of intellectual property and the laws of cyberspace on software security.
Derek Bambauer is a resident fellow at the Berkman Center and a researcher with the OpenNet Initiative's Internet Filtering Project.
Derek's research interests include information control through technical and legal methods on the Internet.
Issues such as spam, cognitive effects on human decision-making, spyware, and data persistence.
Also, the intersection of health law and information technology and the interplay between legal and technical enforcement.
Over the next hour, we'll hear Derek Bambauer speaking at a Tuesday Berkman luncheon, July 25th, 2006.
Audio Berkman is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Howard Law School. For Audio Berkman, I'm Caroline Nilleman.
And I'm Sherry Zhang.
So I think the key element that we actually have technically is the 7-second delay, just in case I get off color during the talk. So Colin's going to prep. Yeah. they put that in when Madonna gave her talk here. So Phil and I, actually, I'm sort of representing both of us in a paper that we're working on together. I'm happy to talk about other stuff that I've done while I'm here, but one of the things I learned from hanging around law professors is they feel entirely free to talk on things that actually aren't on topic whatsoever. They'll show up to talk about digital rights management and talk about e-democracy. So I'm going to take a bit of that just to talk with all of you about the project that we're working on, which is really how we feel that the law currently limits, undesirably, software security research, and to share with you a few proposals for what we might do about that. And I will say that I think we're clearer at this point on the problem than we are on the solutions. And so given the collective legal, technical, and policy wisdom in this room, I'm hopeful that we can carry the ball a little further forward today in our thinking about this with the hopes that it will improve the paper that we're working on. Just as a quick query, how many in the room, raise your hands, have done some sort of security testing on software, infrastructure, things like that? Okay, not too bad. How many of you have actually found bugs? So only a couple of us. When we used to do this for Lotus, we used to call it infrastructure testing or probing, which we assumed if we told customers this would upset them a lot less than saying we're going to poke around your software and see what bugs we can find and then exploit. Of course, we were being paid to do this, which made it even more fun. But this is really what we're thinking about here, because the idea of looking at software for bugs, for things that can be exploited for purposes other than those which the developers intended, is exciting, it's intellectually engaging, it's actually quite socially important, but it's also really legally risky. Engaging in this type of activity opens you up to everything from civil lawsuits, large damage awards, up to and including prison time under federal statutes. And so our hypothesis is that looking at the state of play in this field in the last few years, that the current legal regulation as it exists is hampering security research in a way that is both socially harmful and undesirable, even if just considered from a software perspective. And so just to sort of set the stage, I'd like to take two of the more infamous case studies. So last summer, a guy named Mike Lin, who some of you may have heard of, who was a researcher for Internet Security Systems, found what he had called the Holy Grail. In his testing, he actually found a bug in the operating system for Cisco's routers. These things are quite literally the backbone of the Internet. And his finding pointed the way for the ability to actually mount an exploit on the routers, which is to execute code, for a hacker to execute code on the router that is not something written and certified by Cisco. And this was frankly a bombshell for the very reason that Cisco's routers always had precisely the opposite reputation, that they were literally bulletproof. This was something that could not be done. It was essentially the impregnable, the unbreachable fortress. So the fact that Lin could do this, if in fact it was verified, meant that this reputation upon which Cisco has so much of its gear and so much of its stock price's value was suddenly at risk. So Lin had actually already shared the information about how to do this, about what the vulnerability was and how to exploit it with Cisco. And Cisco had issued a patch, a small piece of software code that would essentially repair the vulnerability. But Lin was frustrated and upset because he felt that Cisco was not pushing their customers hard enough or ardently enough to install and use the patch. And this is perhaps not surprising if you have something that's a critical failure in your valuable networking hardware and software. You may not want to trumpet this to the skies in a time of falling technology stock prices. So Lin actually planned partly for the purposes of encouraging Cisco, but mostly for the purposes of sort of showing off his own skill and research to present his findings, though without, importantly, the exploit code, at the Black Hat Hackers Conference in Las Vegas, which is essentially a who's who of hackers, journalists, researchers, computer science graduate students, and the like. FBI people. Poorly disguised, evidently, FBI people. They really need to tell them that three-piece suits just don't blend in well at Black Hat.
Three-piece pirate suits. That's the coat and the pantaloons and the, you know, as Lewis is modeling, those actually do quite well.
That would be good. And people may just think that you're a Johnny Depp fan these days, so you'd really, you'd look fine. And so he was going to present this on behalf of his employer, ISS. Under what can only be termed a great deal of pressure from Cisco, ISS, basically the night before, asks Lin to pull the presentation, not to give it. Because ISS and Cisco have a strong relationship, as many security research firms do with vendors, and they didn't want to jeopardize it. Lin decides that what he'll do instead is he'll essentially fall on his sword, to borrow the pirate metaphor. He'll resign from ISS and present it anyway. So what happens next, as you might expect, Cisco and ISS lawyer up, and they go to court in an attempt to stop Lin from giving the presentation. And they make claims based on intellectual property, actually. They claim, first, ISS claims that they have copyright in the PowerPoint presentation. Now, anyone who's seen a PowerPoint presentation knows that the amount of original thought and creativity in them is really, really light. So this in itself is not a very plausible claim. The second is that Cisco actually claims that they have copyright in the code, the computer code, that appears in the slides. And this also strikes at least lawyers as frankly dicey because it's almost classically fair use. This sort of excerpting is the sort of thing that we might think of as quoting from a book or movie lyrics in a review, which essentially is what this is. It's a review of Cisco's code, its copyrighted expression. And then lastly, Cisco asserts trade secret. They say that they have this economic value in protecting this information, their computer code. They've undertaken reasonable efforts to maintain its secrecy, and thus, by revealing this, Lin would actually hurt the economic value of this information. So this is under California's trade secret law, and trade secret is sort of an odd branch of IP in that it's mostly state-based, and it's some complex blend of sort of case law and statute. And so they're pressing for a temporary restraining order that will keep him from essentially distributing his presentation, giving it, talking about it, speaking with the media, and so forth. Fortunately for Lin, Jennifer Granick, who runs the cyber law clinic out at Stanford, acts as his lawyer. She's really experienced as both a criminal lawyer and as a cyber lawyer, and manages to negotiate a settlement with Cisco and ISS, where basically he can give sort of a modified version of his presentation and in exchange for basically agreeing to do what he was going to do already, which is not sort of widely shout about the exploit code, he can go forward unharmed. So he's free from the civil side of things. Except, as we mentioned earlier, it turns out that the FBI shows up, that there's a criminal investigation, and it hasn't come out yet, but it's clear that somebody had tipped them, and that this was something either along the lines of a criminal copyright investigation, as you're aware, copyright infringement can result in criminal liability, or possibly something under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which also has criminal provisions. So the story ends reasonably happily. Lin doesn't go to jail, doesn't pay any damages, or he doesn't lose a lawsuit, but he does lose his job. He has at least a few sleepless days and nights with the FBI and various lawyers wandering around. He's fortunate in that he has free counsel from Jennifer Granick, but if this was the sort of thing he had to pay for, lawyers are pretty expensive. And so even though this quote-unquote ends happily, this is a fair amount of pressure, and other people might well learn from this. I mean, to sort of bring Voltaire into this, part of the reason that Cisco does this is pour encourager les autres. They don't want other security researchers following Lin's path and poking too closely at their code.
And just to jump in, if you look at all of the press that surrounded all of these events, the message that comes out isn't, you know, Lin came out of this great, he's in good shape. It was more, poor guy, tried to do the right thing, lost his job, had to quit his job, you know, was harassed and potentially, you know, at risk of these things. So there's very much kind of a dark cloud message that comes out of it that, you know, this is very risky ground for people to get on. And if you're thinking of doing something similar, you better look out. So it's quite a discouraging message.
Which is, in a sense, what's intended. You don't necessarily, I mean, the operation of law is you don't necessarily have to get an outcome. You don't have to win to be successful. All you have to do is sort of implement that chilling effect. The second example, slightly shorter, is that in 2002, a security research company called Snowsoft is trying to get HP to essentially purchase their services as a security tester. And so as a way of sort of proof of concept here, they find a buffer overflow in HP's True64 Unix operating system. And they write this up, they have this information, they're sharing with HP. And another research actually posts this weakness and the exploit code that allows you to do privilege escalation on the operating system to the bug track list and website. And so even though this isn't Snowsoft that's actually posting the information, HP takes offense at this, and they threaten Snowsoft with sort of a litany of cyber law and intellectual property claims, everything from claims under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and even criminal extortion under Massachusetts state law. And they say, well, do this if you don't essentially take down the post and agree never to speak of this again. And HP eventually backs down when Snowsoft and others go to the media. And there's an outcry about the research, the effect on the research community and chilling effects, and basically large corporation pushing small researchers around. And the funny thing here is that Snowsoft claimed, of course, that it had already informed HP about the vulnerability, but the HP hadn't fixed it yet. And part of the reason that Snowsoft is getting insistent, and perhaps part of the reason that this gets published, is that they suspect that what HP wants to do is essentially to appropriate the hard-earned fruits of their labors to, they've now had a set of bug findings presented to them for free, and they can take that information, fix the bug, and never credit or pay Snowsoft for the information. And this set of problems really highlights not only the sort of disparity in power typically between security researchers and large firms, but also the risks of operating in this particular segment. It's not just that you're going to face everything from criminal extortion to IP infringement claims. It's that you may try to put in work to entice a company into hiring you for your services legitimately and simply have that taken away or used without any sort of credit or remuneration. So my hope is that these two vignettes sort of highlight some of the different problems that security researchers face. And now I want to kind of move and just quickly abstract what I think the key challenges are in this zone. So the first and most obvious is that testing for security bugs in software means that as a researcher, you run into and potentially afoul of a host of seminal and criminal laws. So we're dealing with, as mentioned, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and its prohibitions on circumventing, for example, access control measures, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the No Electronic Theft Act, virtually all of the branches of the intellectual property tree. We mentioned trade secret and copyright infringement. There could be patent claims for building a product, for example, or using code that's patented with the increasing expansion for example, in business method patents, even potentially trademark claims. And then we also deal with more garden variety doctrines of law, so contract law, whether, for example, reverse engineering a piece of software to test whether it's vulnerable violates the end user license agreement that we all click through and ignore when we install software, or criminal laws such as trespass or extortion. The second is that the exclusions or safe harbors that are inserted in some of these laws to protect exactly this type of socially beneficial activity are generally narrow. They're typically somewhat uncertain, so they're standards rather than rules, which means that they're more flexible, but they offer less bright-line guidance to researchers. And in some cases, these safe harbors are actually quite untested. So this has to do in particular with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, where some of its exemptions are sort of laid out fairly clearly in the law, but have never really been adjudicated. So no one's quite sure where the boundaries are. This leads to a problem, which is that plays into a more structural industry-based problem, which is that researchers and software companies or vendors have a sort of set of uneasy and shifting relationships, and power typically is strongly on the side of the vendors. They have greater resources, they have more money, they've got more lawyers, and the vendors, generally speaking, also usually have the sort of the prima facie law on their side, which is you're breaking into their stuff. You're trying to essentially crack it. You are, at least on the face of it, violating certain of these laws, even if the exceptions apply to you. And if you're going in front of a judge and trying to convince them, on the one side, you have the titans of industry, such as Microsoft and Hewlett-Packard and Compaq and Cisco. On the other side, you have a bunch of relatively scruffy-looking people with strange nicknames, such as Dr. Mudge or what have you, who are, you know, suffer from having a reputation as hackers, which most judges, not being terribly technologically sound, the only thing they see is movies like Firewall or The Matrix. They think that these are people running amok. And so the complexities in this issue tend to sort of be reduced by the simple, sort of stereotypical aspects of it. There's also, importantly, disagreement even among the security research and hacker communities about what constitutes lawful and ethical practice regarding this type of research and regarding how information should be shared. Should it be shared with vendors 30 days in advance before you make it public, 45 days in advance, 90 days in advance? Should there be an indefinite clock as long as the vendor seems to be fixing it? Should you just publish your information immediately? This lack of agreement and clarity means that it's going to be difficult for outsiders, such as judges, for example, to determine whether, in fact, you are behaving in a way that should fall within one of the exceptions to some of these laws, or whether your conduct is something that should be supported or should be censured. In addition, we've talked about this possibility of essentially outsider, freelance researchers testing software. There's also the potential that the researchers may be working for the vendors. They may have a contractual relationship. And unfortunately, even in this case, you can have situations that are socially undesirable. So, for example, typically, these contracts provide that whatever information, whatever intellectual property is developed by the researchers, the vendors own it. They will, generally speaking, have the right to prevent you from to prevent the researchers from redistributing it or from publishing it. Contrast this, for example, with the safeguards that universities such as Harvard have adopted in an analogous space of research, that into pharmaceuticals and biochemicals, where, for example, the university prohibits any of its labs or researchers from engaging into a contract with the biotech or pharma industry that prevents publication for precisely the same set of reasons. Concern about what this actually does to the commons and concern about the ability to essentially quelch or quash unfavorable information that comes out of this research. And, of course, the researchers are typically operating under NDA. So, as with all non-disclosure agreements, typically violation is something that's very easily remedied by a temporary restraining order that, under pain of contempt of the court, keeps you from talking about this stuff. As we looked at with Snowsoft, when a researcher is not under contract, they may try to entice the vendor by showing them how good their findings are, how skillful they are at probing the software and finding bugs. This, of course, leads to two difficulties. The first is misappropriation. This is why it's not a good idea to send unsolicited scripts to Hollywood studios. because then if it does, you know, if your plot does show up in an episode of Friends, it's very difficult to sue a Hollywood studio and say, no, actually, I sent this in my little, you know, handwritten letter 3 years ago, and you've misappropriated it. So they can just take the fruits of your labor and not pay you for them. And the second, of course, is legal threats. And lastly, for those of you who are sort of a more law and economics bent, some of the standard risk mitigation devices that we typically see as muting these threats are either weak or absent in this particular industry. So first, it's virtually impossible, if not completely impossible, to obtain third-party insurance as a firm that conducts security research. They simply don't offer it. So there's literally a checkbox in most of these contracts that says, if you're engaged in software security testing, check here. And of course, that makes the insurance adjusters or the insurance agent's job very easy, is they just immediately circular file your application. So it's hard because you are essentially taking on considerable legal risk without any of these mitigation devices such as insurance. It's hard to contract ex ante with vendors in a way that can mitigate risk because you have to prove to them that you're good at what you do, but doing so, again, opens you to either them using your research or simply threatening you legally. And there's also the difficulty that vendor self-interest may favor, as with Cisco, the preservation of an inaccurate reputation for security over actually revealing information and fixing bugs. So in this case, the software vendor's self-interest may not press in the direction that we think is socially desirable. So what are our goals with this paper? Well, we all know that software is inherently buggy. And information theory tells us that internal quality assurance or quality engineering can't find and fix all of the bugs in it, especially as the number of configurations, customizations, and environments in which software is used multiply. So outside entities thus have a really important role in finding bugs. Think about, for example, Sony's attempt to release its digital rights management software on CDs, where you install it and it actually puts a rootkit on your computer, which seemed like an excellent way of keeping people from copying music, but turned out to open a whole new vector of attack for hackers. And so we think that the risks here are twofold. First, that this current legal setup will either drive researchers out of this business or lead to inefficient consolidation into large firms. For example, Symantec buying up smaller research firms for the purposes essentially of self-defense. And the other risk is that this essentially goes underground, that the incentives shift to revealing weaknesses to crackers, to, for example, the Eastern European Mafia, rather than to the companies themselves. And so now we want to talk just quickly about two reform proposals and then open it up for your critique, your discussion, and so forth. One reform proposal might be to enhance or better tune the safe harbors that exist in some of these laws. So these might need to be doctrine specific or they might need to be generalized. So take, for example, the DMCA exemption that exists for reverse engineering and security research. Currently, it's narrow, it's quite demanding in terms of what you have to show to fall within it, and it's largely untested. The trend, for example, in patent law is to actually narrow the experimental use exemption to patent liability, which means that if you have patented code, then your ability to make use of that for testing purposes is shrinking over time. And we may, for example, need to refine copyright law and its interplay with contract to clarify that end-user license agreements can't override, for example, things such as fair use or reverse engineering, which would unfortunately push us in the teeth of the way that the law is currently running. And we also need to think about the rather worrisome trend under things such as the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, such as, for example, finding that connecting to a wireless access point that's open, that's unencrypted, without permission, can in fact constitute a criminal violation. Now, in a number of these cases, what we're actually seeing is that this is sort of a stalking horse for people who are downloading pornography or something or other undesirable materials over that access point. But nonetheless, the precedent still holds. So we want to think some about whether we could tweak the existing laws, but we need to acknowledge that it's difficult, and in a lot of cases, it's against the trend of where the law is currently moving. And the second possibility we've been thinking about a bit is some sort of more affirmative proposal. And the way that this might work is along the lines of some sort of licensing or registration system, which gives some sort of protection, some sort of aegis to researchers in exchange for following some type of guidelines for research and disclosure. And this may push us back into the difficult discussion, I hope not too much, of sort of what the right standards are, 30 days, 45 days, and so forth. This might confer perhaps a limited immunity or at least burden shifting, where rather than having to demonstrate that you in fact are worthy of availing yourself of the safe harbor, the other side has to show that you fall outside of it. And this could also potentially and desirably lead to the formation of larger intermediaries such as trade associations and the like, who might be able to fund legal defenses, share information, consolidate people to provide a pool of potential insureds that could attract coverage, and so forth. And so, typically, Colin says that what we try to do with these lunches is to leave you with a tough question, a tough set of problems, what it is we're running into. And as I mentioned at the beginning, we think we've got a pretty good handle on what the difficulties are in being a software security researcher, and we're really trying to grapple with how to improve this. And so what I would like to ask for your help with is actually two things. The first, how can we formulate some reform proposals that are not only effective, but that in particular are effective at protecting smaller researchers, those who don't have a large corporation and its resources behind them? And second, proposals that will essentially enable hacking, enable research, but don't countenance cracking. So this is hard, because what we're ultimately looking at is the question of both of the person's intent in engaging in the research, and also what it is that they do with the information after the fact. So with that, I'd love to get your thoughts, proposals, where we should go, critique. So open it up. Simpson, go ahead.
Yeah, so two things. First, I'm not sure there's a problem, because there are more people doing this now than ever before. It doesn't seem to be a barrier to the free flow of information. And it's also not clear that it's a socially useful activity. You claim it is. I say it's not clear. Because our systems are riddled with security problems, and simply having 5 of them identified out of 5,000 may not actually be that useful. So I think that if you're going to make this argument, you have to do a much better job proving that there actually is a problem. You haven't done it to me. There are clearly people who are involved in extortion, and they call themselves computer security researchers. And there are actually computer security researchers who are not primarily doing reverse engineering. And one of the real problems with computer security right now is it's very difficult to tell the people who are just doing reverse engineering from the people who are actually doing real security research.
Do you have a sense of how we might essentially separate the sheep from the goats? Is there a line?
Many of the people you think of as sheep are actually goats.
Okay.
So I think that many of the people at the Black Hat Conference are just not contributing to the state of the art. They're actually black hats.
But I think we can acknowledge situations in which we have people relying on tools that they believe to be secure, but they're not to be secure.
Oh, I completely
agree
with you.
You know, very serious implications. You know, I'm involved right now with a large security audit that you're well aware of as far as violating the firewall of a particular authoritarian nation, where it's pretty important if people know whether those tools work or not, and there's clearly social benefits to that. I think the question becomes, now that we take this out of the geek realm and into the law realm, how do we draw a line? And it seems to me that intent has a huge amount to do with it. Clearly, some of this work quickly ends up in the realm of extortion. I found a security flaw, hand me this much money before, you know, I reveal it to the general public, is a socially undesirable behavior. I found a security flaw in something that 5,000 people are using to protect their identity from the government of said nameless nation, is a extremely socially valuable thing to do. You know, the only difference there may not actually be in the act of reverse engineering or poking, prodding, testing, whatever. It may be what happens after that act.
So one thing, the other half that you're not talking about is liability for the vendors.
Right.
They have absolute immunity. They can, you know, Cisco puts all its customers at jeopardy, doesn't push them to upgrade, and they have a license agreement that basically says they're not liable for anything they do. So that might be a way of pushing them.
And that's, I mean, we've thought about that primarily as certainly the background to all this. When you have a regime that basically gives immunity or allows vendors to create immunity for themselves from regular liability suits that, you know, manufacturers of most products don't have, like, that is part of what creates a lot more importance on other people, and whether it's, you know, quasi black hats or whether it's big established firms, you know, on someone to find and identify these bugs, because the incentives for the vendors are not what they otherwise would be. So it's certainly part of the backdrop in which these people are operating. It's a whole big subject unto itself of whether that should be the reform proposal that may be beyond the scope of this paper, but you know, it certainly creates the incentives to be the way they are.
It's very unclear to me how you're ever going to separate black hats from white hats. I mean, it's essentially like saying, there's a locked house, and here's the key. Is the person that sets the key in front of the door a black hat or a white hat? I mean, and are they committing any crime? It's the person who enters the house and steals stuff that's committing the crime. So I don't know how you're ever going to separate that. In addition, even if they were a white hat, once they publish, that information becomes available to anybody, and I'm not sure the distinction is relevant at that point.
Although that's part of what Derek was describing, is that, you know, what can people agree on that the right ethical rules are? What sort of advance notice do you give? If you notified the vendor and they've done little or nothing for 60 days, where is the greater risk? Is it letting them continue and having that vulnerability sitting out there, or is it publishing and maybe creating a greater risk that in the remaining interim between your disclosure and when they act, somebody, you know, actually exploits it?
Do you have a sense of if that question can ever be resolved? Because that's a ongoing flame war every 3 months on bug track, right? And everybody has their own spirited opinion on it.
Not to go with the color analogy, but maybe you have some gray hats. They're kind of like floating in the middle. And one avenue, I think one could look into it. I know the decision in Duke-verse, where they basically allowed biotech companies, if you were researching, you could use patented material for that limited research opportunity without violating patents, whereas normally you would otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
One option you could say is to convert those gray hats to white hats, because I think, like many things, there's a lot of people in that middle area who could kind of go toward the right or the left. If somehow, you know, legislation was passed, or, you know, the precedent was set that those individuals could, for example, see a problem and research, use that code for that purpose of showing, you know, for example, like to show that, look, I am a viable assistant, I can give you good bug support without them running the risk of necessarily being taken over by, you know, being pushed around by a large company facing legal issues. I don't know if that's an option or if that's something you guys have thought about, but it would have some precedent so recently. And I think it would be analogous from the biotech to this.
I think you're right. And in the biotech context, one of the things I've thought about, and I'm not sure if this is where you're going, for example, is the ability to experiment with patented pharmaceuticals just before they come off patent, mm-hmm. so that generic drug manufacturers can actually create this to essentially get ready to produce the generic form of the drug as soon as it goes off patent. And this has been held not to be patent infringement by virtue of a special federal statute that essentially allows you to make the patented item, to sort of work the claims, if what you're doing is preparing to submit information to a federal agency. In this case, it's the FDA. And so if you were to take something like the Computer Emergency Response Team and give it some quasi-federal aegis, one might well be able to shoehorn security research into this particular exemption, at least for patent. And so I think that's quite interesting.
Yeah, because I know, I mean, in a lot of the drugs, it tends to be this underlying feeling of public safety and public good and the general benefit of all. And I would imagine that, especially in today's world, security would fall at least in that same general category of saying that if we don't address this now, you don't give people the chance to ramp up to it, there's going to be that window of where the problem is known and there's no fix for it. And you want to make sure that doesn't happen, because then there's no real benefit to either one.
I also wanted to connect a couple threads I'd heard about this idea of essentially what we're talking about a little bit is with black hats, and getting into your gray hat example, is we're pressing towards this idea of extortion or blackmail. And in terms of the criminal law, for example, we have typically thought of blackmail as to be prohibited because it's an act that produces no social benefit. So in other words, normally we think that revealing information publicly, if it's something that you know and you're not under any sort of agreement with the person, you know, about whom the originally created the information, is not liable. But we realize doing so doesn't create new information. All it does is it puts it into the public and allows you to essentially obtain rents on that information. But in this case, what's slightly different is that black hats and even gray hats can produce socially useful information. They may use it in an undesirable way. But the information itself is not previously known if it's a new bug, and it can be useful. It's just that we want to control how it's used. And so in this case, there is at least, I think, the possibility, if you tweak some of the legal settings appropriately, to harness people who would otherwise be bad actors to produce useful information. Looking, jump in.
I like your talk a lot, and I was thinking about the recent example of our friends at Cambridge who found out about the security breach or exploit, whatever you want to call it, of the Great Firewall in China, where there is, I think, a sort of dilemma between legally them reporting it to CertChina, and Slashdot community fell over them a lot about this, arguing that that was a bad case, because the socially desirable implications would have been not to reveal it and, you know, sort of surreptitiously spread across whatever all the users in China, whatever that means, so that they could exploit it. I was wondering what kind of views you have on that issue and how you feel that.
That one's quite difficult because, obviously, this is something where it's technology being used in a way that in the West we regard as pernicious. Right. So we... as a general matter, don't view the Chinese government's ability to censor, for example, discussions of democracy and human rights as creating any sort of social value. The other side of it, of course, is that when Steve Murdoch and the folks at Cambridge, they came and we chatted with them in November about this, and they said, it's a great technique. We think it's a really good way of bypassing the firewall. The trouble is it allows you to do a giant denial-of-service attack on essentially any computer in China. And as much as I'm a free speech person, I don't think that's a great thing. But there is this difficulty, which is that if you report this bug so that you don't give someone the ability to take essentially a huge range of China's computers offline, they can also use it to improve the capability of the firewall. And so we might well think of the same thing. For example, if you had a firewall here in the States, you had the type that not only protects banks from the ability to break in, but also lets companies block employees from sending email with certain messages or access certain websites or things like that. And so I think this this idea that if you have information that is really quite neutral, it can be used in a way that's beneficial, it can be used in a way that's detrimental, makes the problem that much harder. And so I really don't know what to do about this.
Logan, I ended up wondering whether it's ever realistic to suggest that a fix that actually requires software changes for 200 million users in China is realistically distributable without the Chinese government knowing about it. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, the professor's in front of the class and everyone whispers to each other, you know, we're going to do this now. I mean, it's that level of coordination. Certainly the other experiments that have taken place around thwarting the Great Firewall have had a great deal of difficulty scaling up beyond a couple hundred users without getting some sort of outside recognition. So I guess I find myself wondering that if it did gain any popularity as an exploit, whether it wouldn't have necessarily had the same effect as being published.
I was wondering, outside of technology, what is the legal status of a quote-unquote whistleblower? Like, what provisions are there, and is there anything that would be equivalent to a status you could give to a researcher? I'm just curious as to what the equivalent would be. And
It's a great question. We've thought actually of looking to whistleblower protections as models. Unfortunately, these have been at least somewhat weakened in some of the recent, I can't remember the Supreme Court decision this term, that weakened them, at least for federal employees. One thing that we'd have to think about a little bit is that typically, my understanding of the way whistleblower laws are structured is that they protect employees of an entity who report some sort of useful information about particularly illicit activities by their employer. Whereas that might work well potentially if there's a contractual relationship between the security researcher and the vendor, but it works less well where you essentially have freelancers. But on the other hand, I really like this idea you're bringing up of, as a conceptual model, whistleblower protections may well work for us in terms of general their general setup and approach. So I think that's something we should look more closely at.
Because it also seems like, Simpson, when you were talking about some of the risks of the black hats and that people make information publicly available for their own good, with whistleblowers, my understanding is that they make that information available to a small group of people who then investigate that claim, and so you could mitigate some of the negative side effects of people using this information for public or personal gain by offering that protection with enough incentive.
One of the things we've thought about a little bit is that sort of borrowing from, there have been ideas that instead of the patent system, for example, what really ought to offer is a reward-based system. If you put forward a useful invention, you receive some sort of government remuneration. We work like this really only in the field of atomic energy or nuclear weapons research, which you can't patent, but which you can get governmental rewards for. But this idea of essentially governmentally provided rewards for useful research in this area at least has some precedent. It might be interesting.
Can you explain the patenting of the non-patentability of nuclear weapons?
Sure. this is something that I believe comes out of the, I think it's the Atomic Energy Research Act. I might have this wrong. And the act is back in the 50s, and the idea is that, generally speaking, as patent has expanded, the idea is sort of anything under the sun made by man, in Berger's famous ruling in Diamond v. Chakrabarty, is patentable if it's novel, useful, not obvious, and properly described. But the difficulty was that the government didn't want essentially private citizens having exclusive rights in things such as hydrogen bombs or nuclear weapons, for reasons that are clear. And essentially what this legislation did is it just carved out one specific area and said, this is not something for which you can obtain a patent. So it explicitly removes it from the general subject matter coverage of patent. But you can apply for essentially a governmental award, if you will, for this type of thing. I believe it assigns all ownership of inventions in this area to the Department of Energy. I'd have to look that up. To give you an analogous...
Does that still fall under PCP?
I believe so. It's a really good question in terms of the international aspect of it, but I think even the international patent cooperation treaties have some sort of reserve for national security or public order, and I think that this would be commonly understood as to fall within that. One area that kind of illustrates this in a little more concrete way is there was surgical methods. So famously, a surgeon patented a way of correcting the curvature of the eye through a strange X-shaped incision. And it's considered that although this is something that essentially produced a gold mine for the surgeon in question, it has a lot of social disutility problems in the same way we might see here, which is if you have one person controlling access to something that's vital to everybody's vision, if you happen to be born with bad eyes, then the fact that the surgeon can charge $50,000 per operation becomes problematic in its distributional considerations. And also just that, you know, we want to improve people's eyesight. It's a social good. And so what happened is that Congress passed a special exemption that allows you to obtain a patent on surgical techniques, but lets anyone practice them. So in other words, anyone can do this, the eyeball slicing technique, with a few other exceptions to it that allow you to essentially make some money off of people who want to have specialized tools to do this sort of thing. So the idea is that you have to balance sort of essentially the monopoly over the information and wanting to reward it, to encourage it, with the social disutility that it can produce.
dots. There's some analogy there too, to say virus scanners and patches. A white hat might have some kind of intellectual property in the exploit, which couldn't necessarily prevent, say, the vendor from creating a patch, but you might be able to say prevent Symantec from scanning for the exploit without some kind of contract.
That's a very clever one. Someone writes a virus, and then Symantec comes up with a decisive set of search strings to let them detect it. Is that set of search strings protectable as a trade secret or some other form of intellectual property, given that essentially what it is a clever way of detecting someone else's work, where work in this case is something highly undesirable?
Well, assuming that's... I mean, obviously the virus writer would presumably have no intellectual property in it, but the first discoverer of the virus might.
Sure they do. They wrote the virus. You have a copyright on it.
Sure.
They're going to admit it?
I copyright all my viruses. Lately, I've been releasing them under Creative Commons.
Some viruses have copyrights.
Yeah, well, and I saw an article yesterday that compared the virus community to the open source community because it is. But obviously, that's not one that a court would necessarily want to. A court would not see a social benefit in recognizing that copyright, right? Whereas they might. Either a court or you know, from a policy perspective, you might want to recognize some kind of intellectual property in the discovery of that original identified search string. I don't know if that encourages quite the right behavior.
It's a really interesting idea. I think Ethan has this exactly right. And there's a model for it, not in copyright, but in patent, which is blocking patents. So you patent the phone, I patent the ability to have a blinking light on the phone, so I can't practice my patent because it requires your patented phone, but you can't use my blinking light either. And so typically it's thought that this encourages negotiation between the two sides. So obviously we'd have to work around this because you can't really patent a virus, at least not easily. But it's an interesting idea, is the ability to, because what that does is that it deals with this misappropriation problem, is that if you've got a protectable right in it, the company can't just rip it off, but there has to be some back-and-forth negotiation to reward you in some way for it. That's a very interesting idea.
Probably could have added a buffer overflow, right? In the original, whoever first...
There's a lot of prior art.
Yeah, obviously not now, but whenever the first buffer overflow was done maliciously...
smashing the stack for fun and profit.
All of these attacks are patentable. And one of the things that one of my companies was doing was filing for patents on exploits. And the idea would be you would have property of the exploits. You could put them in your scanner. The other legitimate companies would be barred from doing it unless they licensed the exploits. And the bad guys wouldn't bother to license it. But you don't care about that.
But is that something that's socially desirable? Because then you have...
It's always socially desirable to allow people to amass intellectual properties. This is the United States.
It just seems that could lead to a situation where you have a person has to get so many different scanners.
The virus scanners...
That's why we have markets.
Highly motivated to license from the small company, and it would be a way that small company could be rewarded for its work. So now we have the perfect answer for your problem. We just need a patent law clinic, and all the people who have discovered these vulnerabilities can patent them.
And the good thing about this is that it's sort of
year delay.
Stronger IP, right? Which will be hugely popular, admittedly not in the academic community, but still, other than that, it's much more plausible. Yeah.
So how did that work out?
Well, we filed for several of them, and I'm happy to report that I have the patent on the multi-line board dialer, and I have a patent on an audio attack technology that can identify people or computers.
How's your revenue stream?
Well, you know, we're not rich, but the patent kept the company in business.
Oh.
On the other hand, the ARP attack patent, we let go. We didn't bother finishing it.
So it is a non-negligible, it's a non-zero.
Yeah, but you know, most I don't think that that's a reasonable way to go, but looking for some sort of intellectual property regime or publishing regime. The whole reason we have the bug track mailing list is because there were private mailing lists in the early 80s or mid 80s that were full disclosure but closed membership mailing lists for people in academia or people in the research community. And they denied membership to that highly selective community of people who were actually coming up with more exploits. The people who were coming up with exploits felt disgruntled that they weren't allowed to play with the big boys. So they set up their own mailing lists and put better stuff on it. So again, markets at work. And I believe that no matter what you come up with, the status quo will remain the same. There will be people who, because of their social skills or because of their lack of funding or their location in Eastern Europe, don't want to play with your system. They don't want to get licensed. They don't want to submit their inventions to CERT. They work at a Chinese information warfare lab, and you know they don't like their boss today. And this stuff will get out. There'll continue to be companies that feel that they are wrong. And this is where the market has taken us, and it's very hard to see how the law has had a big impact. Although it's kept me out of the
problem. Right. I mean, if your argument is, you know, the markets are great and that's a good way to try to solve some of the vulnerability problems, it seems like changes in the law that make the markets work better, in other words, let people get in more freely without fear of liability, would be good. I mean, it's a little hard to quantify how many people aren't playing now because of fear of liability and how much would they contribute if they did.
I think people are publishing anonymously. Who fear liability, or they're going to the black markets instead of the public markets. Mm-hmm. There's a big market for exploits in the underground world. People have tried putting them on eBay, but eBay keeps taking them down. But there are other sites where you can sell exploits. Just like there are auction sites where you can sell credit card numbers. And I think getting rid of the absolute freedom from liability on the part of the software vendors is probably one easy. I can't think of anything else.
I don't know about easy.
I mean, hard.
Effective,
but very effective. Yeah.
I think you have two good points. One is that we're realists about this in the sense that this is not a perfect solution. All we seek is improvement, and we're fully aware that it's not going. If it moves the line, it moves some. It doesn't move it all the way. The second is that. I think that one of the operations, or one of the assumptions that's typically made, especially by vendors, is sort of the unique stroke of genius, which is that when I, as Mike Lynn or whoever else, come up with an exploit, I'm the only person to have thought of the exploit. It's new, and by squashing me, we can prevent the exploit from coming forward. And I think this assumption is actually wrong, and in this case, it may be usefully wrong. I mean, when you look at the fact that non-Euclidean geometry was invented simultaneously by three different people, it seems that finding bugs in code is going to be, multiple people are going to be finding at the same time. So the fact that one of them is selling it to the underground is not necessarily a problem if our legal system incents the other people who found it to make it known. And so in that sense, even if we can't affect this black hat, these other folks who are gray hats under our current system, incenting them may be a good thing.
So you could have an immunity publication. Mm-hmm. Where if it's published there, you get credit, you don't get paid, but you can't be held liable. There are ways that we can use that, like I can get your trade secrets and publish them there.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's what finding your exploits is. And it has an editor and they publish exploits, they don't publish other things.
That's an interesting point, almost a peer-reviewed or peer-mediated way of doing it.
Some government employee makes a decision, and then we can pressure.
One of the things I want to throw out that we've kind of been talking about a bit, too, is that how hard do people think it is, in other words, to assess intent? Because we have to deal with this in criminal law, right, all the time, is whether or not people essentially have bad intent. I mean, it's always seen as one of the key elements for imposing liability on somebody. And so is it harder in this space to figure out whether somebody wants to sell it to the Russian mafia versus they want to send an email to Microsoft's security team? Is there something unique about software research that makes this harder? Is this just another instance of the general problem? Is there any way we might try to deal with this?
No.
I mean, to me, I think that's exactly where it comes down to. You know, intent matters throughout criminal law. And, you know, whether I'm breaking into your house to steal your flat panel television or whether I'm breaking into your house to rescue your pet dog from a fire is an enormous difference. You know, whether I'm breaking into your router because, you know, I'm trying to demonstrate that there's a security problem that's going to bring down all of the routers in my university may be very, very different than breaking into your router so I can sell the knowledge of how to do it to the Chinese government.
But results are equally important.
You don't need to break into my router. You can buy a router. You can go to another router. There's a big difference here.
I'm making a really loose analogy. I agree with you.
And if Cisco was breaking into my code that I protected by this license agreement.
That's what I'm trying to say, and I'm saying it that way.
Okay.
I agree with you. I mean, generally speaking, the way to do this is not to... But then again, on the scenario that we have, you know, vaguely alluded to, if you do wish to test the security services of a particular oppressive nation and the function of their firewall, it's real tough to call up the government of China and say, excuse me, I'd like a great firewall. I'm going to install it in this lab over here. I'd like an exact copy, please.
Even if you had the best intentions, I would encourage you not to try to find exploits in the eBay website. Just don't look for security vulnerabilities at eBay, because that's...
Are you suggesting that this is now how I find anything global?
Not
necessarily.
I mean, is the problem there that the only way to monetize an exploit at eBay is in the black market?
Well, allegedly you could sell it to eBay, or you could use it to get a job at eBay, but if you're going to look for interesting holes in web-based applications... You shouldn't do it in production systems. And if the only systems that you have access to are production systems, because eBay doesn't sell eBay on a CD-ROM, so you can run your own eBay, then those systems are systems that you, as a legitimate researcher, better not go after, because you'll be put in jail.
Is that, going back to your early point, is that societally beneficial, though? Do we want an outcome that says it's just too risky?
Because it's too hard to make that... judgment about intent. You know,
I mean, I hate to sound like the NRA, but if guns are illegal, if exploits are illegal, then only criminals have exploits.
And so you're doing it, but you know, and it's eBay's job to make sure that they're not being hit. And there are lots of holes in eBay.
But we know that eBay's not going to be able to do a good job of that.
And then they'll fail; their stock price will go down. You know, it'll be bad, but. Okay.
I still think intent is not the only parameter. I think results matter. I think the effect of what you do and how you do it, now that obviously has implications if you publish something and that somebody else takes action in a negative way, but it matters whether you shoot somebody and they die or not. The results of your action makes a difference in your punishment. Maybe not in your criminality, but I'm not...
Yeah, but if you were shooting them to see what would happen if they, like, got a bullet through their gut, just because you were, you know, if they had a security vulnerability there.
Right.
But yeah, by the way, the story I just posted, Simpson Garfinkel, suggests that when looking for internet exploits, do not look for eBay. I mean, seriously, eBay is not where I would look for a security exploit. Has already gotten 15 digs, so it's doing quite well.
I just said this. Is that the same standard, though, that you would want applied to something like the Big Dig? I mean, there are a lot of systems that have tremendous vulnerabilities, and you can either wait for a casualty, or you can open up the process to find the break.
Yeah, but you don't hire freelancers to go take, you know, meetups and hits to the Big Dig ceiling tiles to see if they're any good or not. There's a process, and eBay has, their regulators are supposed to be looking at eBay, or more... I wish there were regulators who were supposed to be looking at PayPal, but they're not a bank. You know, but and they
know
have.
Those, but we know those regulators aren't competent.
Yeah, they have, they have insurance companies. That are
or to be fair,
at this,
don't
they
have time.
They hire KPMG and you know companies like that.
But we know, but we know those people aren't. This is not, you know, this is not tunnel engineering.
Yeah.
If things start falling off the roof of the tunnel, we say those people are criminally negligent. If software fails, we say, it's software.
Well, it
because
software,
because
right?
It is a different order of magnitude of a problem. Right?
If it's software that's running a medical system, there's a very different standard. If it's software that's running a car and brakes start failing, you know, there are recalls. You're thinking about one particular piece of software. There's lots, you know, software in aviation is a very different standard than software at eBay. And you know, if eBay goes off the air tomorrow and never comes back, it's really sad for all the eBay shareholders.
I want to follow up because I think there's an interesting point I want to try to write. So, Christina, I want to let you jump in first if you're up for it.
I'm going to have to run and pick up my daughter.
Okay.
My question was just that, you know, you say it's all, like, the worst that can happen if something happens to eBay is that their stock drops. But what about a system like, for example, this happened a few years ago, Diebold, you know, they found all these security flaws in their voting machines. And had it not been for the bunch of people who put all of their code up on the web and, you know, published it and got sued by Diebold, like, you know, that's not the worst that can happen. You know, like, the worst that can happen is someone gets reelected, you know?
God forbid.
Like, I mean, stock prices is the issue, but with eBay, another issue could be, you know, identity theft, and people could lose, you know, their entire life savings.
Yeah, eBay is
like
a,
that.
What,
so,
what do you call it, concentration of liability? Or potential liability? What's that, the term?
That's a good question. I'm trying to figure out the degree to which they're liable, or...
Yeah, I think they're liable if they release that stuff. But you know, as far as the Diebold stuff goes, all those towns that approved those machines for use in the elections should have had better approval systems.
That, I mean, you can say that, and that's true on one level. But the world that we live in is they don't.
Yeah, everyone.
No, so do we want a system that relies on towns and insurers and others who
you don't want people
historically don't
elections
do their job?
Either, right? You know, somebody comes in and says, "Oh, I was just pressing all the buttons." Because I was testing the security of this machine, and you know, the only time I could get access to this machine was during election day. So I'm not actually trying to tamper with the election. I'm a security researcher, and I'm just testing this machine. And, you know, I found a way to create these additional votes for my candidate Q, and I just wanted to see if it would actually be reported in the newspaper that candidate Q won, and then I was going to report it.
That's equivalent to bringing a gun through airport security.
Just to test out airport security, yeah, you know. And there was this kid that was doing that, remember?
Mm-hmm.
It was like, smoke, but he had a sickness. See, he wasn't really a security researcher. He was sick. And...
aren't also security researchers?
Software is being so well and so carefully tested on every possible axis that I don't have to worry about this because the very smart security researchers out there who have my best interests at heart and are out there to protect me and who are representatives of the democratically elected government that I supported, you know, are going to keep me from having, you know, PayPal steal my credit card or something along those lines. I mean, you know, so don't you worry your little head about it. Just, you know, just trust that we'll take care of you. I mean, I think this analogy breaks down.
It's such a hard
awfully quickly.
I know it is.
I think that the interesting thing is I think SimSit is pushing on one of our assumptions. I said up front, our assumption is...
You're pushing on your very first assumption as I'm writing this up, which is that it's a desirable thing to test this stuff.
And I mean, if he...
Unrestricted.
Simpson, if you're right, then, in fact, we're writing the wrong paper, which is entirely possible. I'm not at all opposed to this, which is, look, what we would really do better is to tighten a lot the laws.
I'm just pushing you. I think the first thing I said, and I do have to run, was I think you need to do a better job showing that there's harm and showing that the current regime is causing a desirable outcome that you believe not to take place. People are being... pull back from doing the socially beneficial security testing. There was this great, you know, the last issue of ACM Communications was all about hacking, and, you know, read those articles. Not the best that they ever published, but endemic, you know, indicative of people doing the research. Prove that there is a social value here. I believe that some of the people doing security vulnerability penetration testing hacking are useful. And I believe a lot of people doing good research are frequently mistaken for doing that kind of stuff. But I don't think that the majority of the stuff is being energy spent in the right way. You know, prove me wrong.
I think you're right. The hard part is when there was one of the counsel from Microsoft was here about 18 months ago and was talking about the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And he said, look, we don't see a chilling effect. We don't think it's out there. And he immediately got roasted because you can't prove chilling effects. The data is not amenable to being gathered. And so you're right, but the sad part is we wind up reasoning largely by anecdote, which is rather unsatisfying to researchers, but we don't have much else because we just can't say how many people decided to go work for IBM.
You can do comparative studies. You can look at other countries which have different computer fraud acts. You can do survey data. You can ask people like me who are in the security community and don't primarily do vulnerability assessment, why is it that they don't do that? You can, you know, survey 1,000 people and do qualitative and quantitative research. We know how to do this kind of social science research. And it will make your case stronger, right?
That's a good point. There are some techniques that we could use. I know we're getting close to time.
Yeah, I think we should wrap it up. So okay. I don't know if you and Phil want to have some last words.
I've yammered a lot.
Final words.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I don't want to take your tiny bit of truly remaining time. So
are you sure you don't want to give it? No. Basically, just actually just wanted to thank all of you. It's been a lot of fun being here in all my roles, and I'm very, very grateful for the time and for the intellectual energy and fun that all of you provide. So actually, the thanks is to you. And that's it.
You've been listening to Derek Baumbauer speaking at a Tuesday Berkman Luncheon, July 25th, 2006.
To learn more about Derek, the OpenNet Initiative, or other Berkman Center projects, visit us on the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Audio Berkman is a production of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Howard Law School.
Online at blogs.law.harvard.edu/audioberkman.
For Audio Berkman, I'm Caroline Nilleman.
And I'm Sherry Zhang.